Well, 20 more days until Halloween, so we're going to talk a little bit more about ghosts and strange hauntings. Brennan Storr joins us, and his book is called A Strange Little Place, and he's next with us on Coast to Coast AM. Welcome back to Coast. Brennan Storr with us, A Strange Little Place, The Hauntings and Unexplained Events of One Small Town. Brennan is a researcher, lifelong interest in the paranormal. He works in a haunted office building in Victoria, Canada. Brennan, get out of there, the most haunted city on the western Canadian coast. So I'm going to bring you in, Brennan, first of all, and say happy Thanksgiving to you, too.
Well, thank you very much. I appreciate it. And I tell you, as soon as I can get out of that haunted office building, I will.
What are you doing in there? I guess it's because of your work. You're stuck there, huh?
That's it. I will say on the bright side, we're up on the third floor now where it's not so bad. The second floor seems to be where most of the activity is located. And I tell you, it was not a great place to be after about 7 o'clock at night. Now upstairs, I can make it all the way to 9:30.
My first radio job in Detroit, I was 21 years old, was the station was in a funeral home. And many nights I was there all by myself in the station. And, I mean, it was creepy because you still had the elevators for the bodies because they did everything down in the basement. And, I mean, I swear, Brennan, you could hear things going, you know, and, you know, I was the only guy there. I mean, unbelievable. Hated it. Loved the job. Hated the funeral home.
Yeah, that's not okay. Nothing that dramatic has happened in our place, though I will say we have noticed there's a, what I like to call a thickening of the shadows past a certain point, say about 9 or 10. If you stayed that long downstairs, if you had all the lights off, you'd notice that the shadows would thicken up in certain spots, and you'd feel like there was someone standing right behind you. You'd look back, and you'd think, well, that's just the way it looks. But you realize, no, you can see clear through to the next room, and whatever was there is now gone.
I'm looking forward to this because you bring to the table a very unique perspective. You were once a diehard atheist, and now you're a believer. Tell me about that.
Well, I was raised in the Catholic Church. My Italian grandmother, bless her, tried very hard to instill in me a sense of respect for the cross and everything that goes with it. And I guess you could say I'm sad to say I didn't take. And the older I got, the more questions I asked. The more questions I asked, the more answers I realized were not there. And eventually, by my early 20s, I decided, well, no, I've got this figured out. And atheist might be a bit strong, but I suppose looking back, you could say I was a hard agnostic. But either way, I was relatively convinced there was nothing outside myself. And this lasted until I was 29, and I started working on this book. And once I started looking into the things that are, I guess you could say, on the other side of reality, they started looking back. And after a while, it was hard to remain an atheist for long.
Now, you're in a small little town in Victoria, Canada. Tell me a little bit about the town. Is the town itself haunted?
Well, I live now in Victoria, Canada, which is on the west coast. I'm originally from the small town of Revelstoke.
That's even smaller, isn't it?
It is. About 7,500 people is the current population, and I don't believe it's risen above 10,000 since the early 1980s. Now, the town itself is unique in that it is completely isolated. It's on the main highway, the Trans-Canada Highway, but it is to the west, an hour, I would say 45 minutes to the next town, to the east, an hour and a half. The roads north and south, both dead-end reservoirs. They don't go anywhere but to the water. In the winter, the town can be cut off for as much as a week at a time by snow. So though it is it's a central part of the coast-to-coast transit network, it's still a very lonesome little place. And I think I knew growing up that it was strange. But again, it wasn't until starting work on this book that I realized how strange. Now, it's been described to me by someone who is a lot more versed in these things than I, by a psychic, as a matter of fact, as a window area, as a thin spot. They remote viewed the location and told me that typically when they encounter such a place where things from one side can come through to ours, they view it as a screen door. They said that Revelstoke, the holes in the screen were larger than anything they'd ever seen.
I wonder why. You think it could be because it's maybe on a ley line, it's in a portal area? What do you think is so special about it?
It's hard to say. I certainly am not sure about ley lines, but I tend to think, if anything, it is a portal area. The area has been steeped in tragedy for at least as long as the town has been there. The area east of town was home to over 200 avalanche-related deaths prior to 1911. That's more than a third of them has been recorded in the entirety of Canada since the late 1800s. So this is a very, very, very damaged area in terms of psychic damage. And you could say there has been a lot of tragedy. Prior to the First World War, Revelstoke was on its way to becoming a very major player in the within the Western Canadian province of BC. However, when World War I broke out, in what was then 5,700 people, more than 1,000 of our young men were called away to war. Of course, after the war ended, more than 100 of those didn't come back. And that took something very, very real from Revelstoke, intangible but real. And whatever was left of the town's morale was finished off by the Depression. And the town, once destined for great things, never really turned out to be much of anything great. It's a lovely little spot, but it's certainly not what it was intended to be.
How long did you live there?
I lived there the first 23 years of my life.
23 years. So I assume you knew about some of the paranormal activity there while you were still living there.
Very little, actually. And that was one of the most fascinating things about the journey I took on the road to writing this, is that 95% of the stories that I encountered were unknown, completely unknown to me prior to starting this. I didn't even really, as I said, I was an atheist. I didn't really believe that these things happened. So I'd heard one or two things from my family growing up about, for example, the house they grew up in, or about other places around town. But most of these were completely new, and I think we all sensed Revelstoke was strange. But now we have some tangible evidence of this.
Brennan, what was the catalyst? What was the big clunk that made you really want to start investigating all of Revelstoke?
The initial impetus was just the idea to start recording family stories, but the big clunk, the thing that really put me on the trail, actually came after I began work on the book. It was just sort of an idea during my first research trip, but when I got back to Victoria and I saw a shadow person for the first time, at that point, I was hooked. I was never more frightened in my life, and I was never more certain that this is what I wanted to do.
Well, and you've done it in a big way, too, with this incredible book, A Strange Little Place. So how strange is Revelstoke, do you think, compared to other cities?
Well, the fascinating thing about Revelstoke is not just the intensity of the phenomenon, it's the variety. We have everything from garden variety haunting, you'd say the idea of psychic energy expending itself in a particular location. The courthouse is a great example of this. We have this magnificent neoclassical courthouse from when the town was meant for greater things. And night shift janitors have described hearing voices, always the same, on the second and third floors. Men talking and a door closing. Children crying, the sound of chains. Always the same. So you could say it's, again, perhaps the idea of emotional energy trapped in the marble and the stone that make up the building. We've got that. We've got gremlins, something I'd never even heard of before, something I'd never considered. Tiny little shadow people which cause electrical disturbance and just general nuisance. We have lights in the sky. We have a full-on story of missing time from the highway east of town. We have a number of Bigfoot stories going back as far as the 1970s. And then, of course, we have one of our greatest things, which I call the Rogers Pass Fireball, which was a magnificent display which frightened terribly the people who saw it, so much so that they really refused to talk about it. It was a difficult story to put together. So what sets Revelstoke apart from other places is that it's not just haunted, but it's bedeviled by so many different things that it really raises the question of whether or not these things are as separate as we think they are.
Once you moved out, how difficult was it to track these stories and do the research?
The most difficult part was simple logistics, getting back and forth, because I work. Some of the stories were simple. Some of the simple hauntings people were eager to talk about. Other stories, less so. Other stories, again, for example, the Revelstoke or the Rogers Pass Fireball, I was actually threatened while researching.
By whom?
One of the witnesses. I approached his home. He was out in his driveway washing his truck, and I had just come from interviewing someone else who had given me his name, so I thought I'd swing by his house and have a chat. And as I got out of my car, I had my recorder in my hand, and I was listening to the previous interview just to remind myself what I needed to ask.
Right.
And when I raised the subject to the fella, he looked at me and said, "You put that recorder away. You put it away right now." And so I did.
Wow.
And he said, "You get out of here. Don't you tell anyone you spoke to me. I don't want to hear my name associated with this at all." Now let's get out of here.
Why do you think has changed?
Well, I think the issue is that it's a small town, and of course these subjects are still considered by some people taboo. They're concerned that they're going
to... Sure, so you're nuts if you talk about them, right?
That's exactly it. I had some teachers, for example, tell me stories and ask me to not use them in the book because, again, they just did not want to risk their place in the community. So I was really running up against just a lot of very, very long-standing taboos, both of the paranormal and small towns.
Let's go through, Brennan, if we can, the types of stories, and then we'll get into specifics after the break. But, I mean, give me the topic of what was going on in terms of the hauntings, UFO activity. What was it?
Well, UFO activity runs the range from simple a trail of sparks running over the top of the mountain to a man losing up to, I believe, 3 hours of his night while driving on the road.
Uh-huh.
We've got stories of darting lights through the trees. The orange, the often mentioned orange triangle has been seen above Revelstoke a number of times. Three orange lights in a triangular formation moving throughout the night sky. The hauntings, again, run the range from simple repeating noises to a spectral girl who was trying to communicate, but whose words were swallowed up by a hum. We've got a seemingly entire second geography of the town, which only reveals itself to people who dream. And that's something that's still developing and is absolutely fascinating to me because it's, again, it continues to challenge my notions of what I think is real and what is not.
Favorite type of story, what was it?
Favorite type of story had to be, for me, I'd say had to be the house on the bank, simply because you've got stories about haunting going back as far as the 1930s, all of them consistent. Different people, different families, different residents over the course of 80 years, all talking about the same things. They tried to reconfigure the house to disrupt the phenomenon, thinking it was a wind current, thinking it was a this or a that, unable to do it. Whatever was there is there and will probably be there a lot longer than you or I.
Do you think the residents of Revelstoke are happy that you went with this book?
I think so. And that's been the most gratifying part of this to me is taking people from Revelstoke and showing them a side of their town that they didn't know existed. I mean, that was the most gratifying for me personally. The thing I took away from this was that I learned more about my hometown in 3 years of writing this book than I did in 23 years of living there.
How many stories did you want to include that you did not because people just didn't want it revealed?
There were a handful. There were a handful that I would have loved to include because they were, in some cases, dramatic. But because they related to disappearances of people who have never been recovered or to tragedies surrounding people whose families are still alive, I just thought it was in poor taste to continue. But there were a number of tales that, again, maybe one day can be told, but for now I think they have to stay in the vault.
And why Revelstoke? I mean, have you truly concluded why this area has the highest incidence per capita, let's say, of ghost stories?
I think it's a combination of the fault lines running through the nearby mountains. We're surrounded, literally surrounded by mountains 7,500, 9,000 feet high. I think some people believe spirits travel along these fault lines or that the magnetic activity somehow draws these things. I think it's a combination of that. And I think it's also the isolation. I think it allows these things to pollinate. I think it gives them space to grow. I think they like being there in the middle of nowhere. And part of me wonders if all of the hubbub surrounding this book and the way people have become aware will simply fade with time because that's what the town wants.
I mean, you chronicled over 70 years of unusual occurrences, didn't you?
Absolutely. Up to 80, actually.
Oh, my gosh.
And these are, again, previously untold, never heard before. This is stuff that, again, most of the people living there did not know. And, again, it just seems like such a strange thing to go unheard of for so long. I have to wonder if there was a reason. Again, if maybe the town itself wants to stay anonymous. Certainly, it is, as I said, it's come close to prominence, to national prominence before, and then various things have set it back, and I just wonder if, there's something there that likes it that way.
What percent of stories, Brennan, were just truly frightening as opposed to, nuisance-type ghosts or things like that?
I would say about 25% of them. There was only one particular story that really, while writing about it, unnerved me. And that was a story of missing time. While writing that story, there were a number of occasions where I was alone in my apartment. I found myself certain I was being watched. And as crazy as that sounds, I stopped a number of times, left the house, called people, because every other story was, there were unnerving ones. Holton House particularly has a real pull to it. It's a large bed and breakfast in the town's center. But that story of missing time, that just haunted me. And it, no pun intended, of course. And it just made me feel unsafe. And I've never experienced missing time. I've never really had a UFO encounter. But that story of a man losing two and a half hours of his life seemed to just inspire within me this dark, dark fear.
That, yeah, I know. That is kind of edgy, isn't it?
Oh, it absolutely is. It just, I don't know if it touches on old cultural fears or some deep primal part of us, or maybe there's something I don't remember.
Was there anything in the book that you touched on that you really didn't want to go there, but you did?
The missing time was the only one, and again, that's because I feel like it's like it approached certain things that I wonder if maybe I've tried to forget. Actually, I should say that, and the second, geography of dreams, as exciting as that has been, it points to things which I would prefer to think are simply figments of my own imagination, but the fact that other people are sharing said figments make me wonder if that's truly the case. And so I would say that those two things, most of all, really, really challenged me, because I thought, these are great stories, I need to write about them. I should say, actually, the second, geography of dreams, isn't even in the book. This is something that has developed since the book went to print.
Since you've gone back there, after you moved out after 23 years, how often have you gone back there?
I went back about, I would say, four or five times a year during the process of writing the book, and each time more information would come to me, each time I gained a deeper sense of the place, and I will say each time I felt like something was more and more aware of me.
That's what I was going to say. Did you feel more paranormal activity the more you went back?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, absolutely. There were, I'm a night owl. I'm always up driving around at night taking pictures. That's just the way I've always been.
Listening to this radio show, right?
Exactly.
Perfect.
I managed to catch your show in Coquitlam a few years back. That was
perfect.
A lot of fun. But, I'm very much a night owl. But as time progressed, as I was working on the project in Revelstoke, I found myself unwilling to be out at night by myself. I felt very...
Wow.
And this seems dramatic. I felt very exposed.
That's scary all by itself.
That's it.
When you lose that kind of control... And, you're looking over your shoulder, that's a very unnerving feeling, isn't it?
Especially in a place that previously had been welcoming. You know, it's your home. Again, I grew up there. I felt like I knew every inch of the place. And yet, on a moment's notice, the quality of the light would change. The quality of the darkness would thicken. And I felt like I was in a strange place, like I was in enemy territory, and something was very aware of me. And whether it was a benign awareness or a malevolent one, it was hard to tell. I mean, I don't have the equipment to make that distinction. I'd like to think it's the former, but based on some of the things I discovered, it could very well be the latter.
All right, let's get into some specific cases when we come back. Brennan Storr, our guest, his website, largelythetruth.com, which is linked up at coasttocoastam.com, and his book is called, again, A Strange Little Place. Hey, Tuesday, tomorrow, we're going to have our chat with you Coast Insiders, 8 p.m. Pacific time, so make sure you're part of the program. Really looking forward to that. And welcome back to Coast, George Norrie with you, our guest, Brennan Storr, his book, A Little Strange Place. We're talking about a small little town in Canada called Revelstoke, and all kinds of paranormal activities happen there. I mean, I'll just give you a litany of some of the things that were going on out there. All kinds of secrets and bizarre encounters, Sasquatch, UFOs, hauntings, missing time, and so much more. I mean, it's endless, Brennan, isn't it?
It certainly seems that way, and ever since the book has come out, there's been more and more stories, so I think endless is the right word.
Okay, let's talk about some of the stories here. I want you to not reveal the entire book, of course, but let's give us a few of your favorites.
Absolutely. So one of my favorites is The Girl in the Blue Dress. This is set south of town on a road called Airport Way. Once upon a time, prior to the damming of the Columbia River, there were a number of communities on this road, but of course, once the river was dammed, the reservoir rose, and many of those towns were moved. On some days when the river is low enough, you can still see foundations of homes just below the surface of the water. It's a fascinating area, and there are a number of stories from there, but the one of the girl in the blue dress really stands out. So down Airport Way, past a number of neighborhoods, there is a house. I'm unfortunately not able to identify the specific location because the family living there are very sensitive to these things.
No, I understand that. Sure.
Absolutely, yeah. But
we're not going to force you to give us the address.
Of course. But in the mid-2000s, a family moved into the house, and the mother first noticed what sounded like footsteps going up and down the stairs. She would wake up in the night and hear what sounded like someone going up and down the stairs, and she at first thought it was one of the kids, so she got up and checked, and all three of her daughters were in bed, and then she thought it was the cat. Well, the cat was outside, and sometimes those sounds would continue until the morning. She thought it was her imagination until maybe several weeks later her daughters came to her and said, "Mom, these noises, they keep coming up and down the stairs. We don't know what they are." And the girls had a sleepover one night with a number of their friends, and the next morning the girls came to her and said, "Mom, the cat just went insane in the hallway last night. We don't know what's wrong with her." And the mother said, "Well, the cat's been out all night. I just let her in."
So,
So this continued, and then one morning the mother walked downstairs, and the pantry, which is right at the bottom of the staircase, all six of the cupboards were open. The cupboard doors were open, and it was only just by catching herself at the last minute she managed to avoid walking face first into these wooden doors. When her husband got back from work later that day, she said, "Very funny, jerk. You left the doors open trying to give me a black eye." She thought he had played a prank on her. He had no idea she was talking about. According to him, when he left, those doors were closed. So she thought, well, again, this is something that you could write off. This is something, it's not normal exactly, but it's just, it's maybe a trick, something to do with the way the floor is set. And she wrote it off. But strange things persisted. She noticed that a Venetian blind in one room just liked to go up and down on its own. She'd set it one way, come back an hour later, and it was the other.
Oh.
Again, nothing dramatic. But then one of her daughters woke up one night and looked out the door of her room into the hallway where the family computer sits.
Okay.
She noticed that the light on the tower was blinking. She thought, well, that's odd. As her eyes adjusted to the darkness, she realized the light wasn't blinking. The office chair in front of the computer was just slowly turning.
Oh, boy.
Yes. And that seemed like enough to convince them, maybe it's time to get moving. But then the appearance of the little girl in the blue dress changed everything for them. And this happened on a bright summer day, as many of these things often do. We get used to the idea of dark and stormy nights, but in my experience, these things happen just as often as in the daytime. The young girl, the youngest daughter, was talking to her mother. All the women of the family were in the yard. The father was off on a business trip. And she casually mentioned her new friend. And after a couple times, the mother said to her, "Well, who's your new friend?" Because she wasn't aware of anyone having moved into the neighborhood. "Where does your new friend live?" And the little girl said, "Well, she lives with us." And the mother said, I'm sorry?" And she goes, Yeah, she lives with us. And we talk at night. And she's got long black hair and she wears a blue dress." And the mother thought, well, that's strange, but kids have invisible friends. This is not of itself that odd. It was mentioned once or twice, but again, she wrote it off as a child's fancy. 10 years later, they'd moved out of the house, and another family was living there.
10 years later?
10 years later.
Jeez.
Actually, this happened in 2012. So the mother who had previously lived in the house got a phone call one day, and it was a woman whose daughter had just babysat in her old house. And she told her this story. And I guess
wow,
the family that's living there now have two small children, a boy and a girl. And one day the babysitter was playing with the kids, And the young girl who lives there now told the babysitter, I have a little sister. And the babysitter said, no, you have a brother. He's right over there. And the little girl said, no. I have a little sister. She comes to me at night, and she stays till early in the morning, and then she goes back to the bushes. And she has brown hair, and she wears a blue dress.
Oh, and that's chilling.
The same thing, 10 years apart, unrelated families.
Same thing.
But the phantom remains. And what's fascinating is I've heard of this same spirit, hallucination, whatever you want to call it, turning up in other places. There's a story, a case of this from, I want to say, eastern Pennsylvania, where a small child reported the same thing. So is it the same little girl, or is it something that presents itself to children that way?
That's a good question. But nobody gets hurt.
Nobody gets hurt. There just seems to be this insinuating itself into the lives of the children. And again, it's not malevolent in and of itself, but it's certainly unnerving.
Tell me about this accidental exorcism that you might have been a part of.
The accidental exorcism. Well, as a matter of fact, that accidental exorcism happened the night after seeing your show at the River Rock Casino in Richmond.
Aha, uh-huh. Okay. So I get the blame for this one, right?
We'll give you a little bit of it.
All right.
So this actually goes back to my very first research trip in Revelstoke. I left from Victoria, come back, I'd done my research, come home, and I was at work, again, on the second floor. This is back when we were still on the more haunted floor of the haunted office building, telling the receptionist about what I'd seen, what I'd heard. And again, it was a bright spring day. It was late April, and we were the only people in the office that day. As I told her the things I'd heard and seen, in an office directly behind her, which again was empty, I see from behind a coat rack an all-black head slowly peek out, hold, just long enough for me to know it's there, and then disappear again behind the coat rack. Now, I'd never heard of a shadow person at that time. I had no idea what I'd just seen, but internally I panicked, and the colors started to bleed out of the day. I managed to catch myself so that I didn't make a fool of myself in front of this gal, but I was really uncertain as to what I'd seen. Cut to 2 weeks later, I'm lying in bed again. I woke up about 8 in the morning. My wife had gone to work before I had, and the sun was coming in through the blinds. Again, it was May by this time. It was a lovely day. And out of the corner of my eye, I see something, and I think, well, that's odd, because the way the bed is situated, nothing could be standing there. I turn to look, and I see a shadow in the shape of a man. And before I can react, it falls across me in the bed, hits me, and I feel what feels like electricity racing through my body. And even though it seems completely counterintuitive, I fell back asleep. I woke up half an hour later, and I thought, did that really happen? No, that's crazy. But that marked the beginning of the blackest, most serious depression I have suffered since I was a child. When I was a teenager, I had very bad depression. This is the worst it had been since then.
Wow. What caused it as a teenager?
I can't really point to any specific cause, although having this particular experience did remind me that when I was a child, I had read, my grandmother used to read tabloids, and so I would read tabloids too. I developed a fixation on gossip early in life, and I recall in one of these tabloids, there was an article about opening yourself to the earth so you have more energy. And as I was cross-pollinating my tabloid habit with comic books, I thought, well, this sounds like it could be interesting. So being maybe 7 or 8 years old, laying in bed, I tried this exercise for opening yourself to the earth and drawing in energy and felt, of course, nothing. Until about 8:30 in the winter, it was a winter night, so it was dark by this time, and I noticed what looked like bats were flying above me. And I thought, oh, crap. They took the screen off my window, and these bats have gotten in. And so I tried to sit up to call for someone to get rid of these things, but I couldn't move. And I watched these things dip and swirl above me, and I thought, I've never seen bats that look quite like this. And as I thought that, they rose and then dove and flew through my chest. And it sounds ludicrous, but it happened. And again, I felt this electricity all throughout my body, and I fell asleep. Now, I don't know if that marks the point in my life where my depression became serious. But I know that there was a point in my childhood development where I changed. I went from being very outward child, very happy, very, you know, I was the class clown.
Might you have been possessed?
Well, funny you say that, because after this experience as a man, when this thing fell across me in bed, I felt like something was weighing on me. I felt like I was carrying around a ton of bricks, like someone else was driving and I was watching.
Right.
And this lasted until I provoked an argument with my wife. And this is not something I do, but I provoked a terrible fight. And after that, it was gone. It was like a boil burst.
Huh.
And so I never saw, I didn't see the shadows again for a long time. And then I was in Vancouver in 2013, a year after this experience, a year after seeing the shadows and having this awful feeling, when I would have my exorcism. And that started, like a lot of these stories, on a bright day, on a busy street. I was in Vancouver for a number of shows back-to-back, one of which was, as I mentioned, your show at the River Rock.
Mm-hmm.
And I left my rented room to go read my book at the local coffee shop. And as I left the house, I heard a voice say, "Hello." I turned and looked, and there was an elderly man of Indian descent, First Nations, as we say, and he appeared to be homeless. He had a gray jumpsuit on, sort of a windbreaker and sneakers, with a beat-up gym bag over one shoulder and a wooden walking stick with orange electrical tape wound around the bottom in his right hand. He hadn't looked like he hadn't shaven in a while, and he was missing some teeth. And I said, "Oh, hello." He said, "How are you?" I said, "Oh, I'm well, thank you. How are you?" And he said, "Well, I could use a coffee as I travel, but other than that, I'm fine."
Was he asking for one?
He wasn't. And the entire time we were together, he never asked for a single thing.
Huh.
And I think that's significant, because I said to him, "Well, tell you what, I'm going for a coffee. Walk with me. I'll buy you one, too."
Yeah.
So we walked, and he introduced himself, or I introduced myself, and I asked him his name. And he told me, and then he asked if I wanted to know his spirit name. I said, "Of course." And he told me, he said it was Thunderbird Heartstrong. I said, "Okay." And he asked if I wanted to know mine. And I said, "Sure." And he said, "Well, when we get to the coffee shop, I'll ask and see if you have one." He said, "Not everyone has one," which I thought was interesting. So we got to the coffee shop, and I'm used to buying coffee for homeless guys. Typically, it follows a pattern.
Oh, good for you, Brian. That's nice.
That's something we got to do, right? So buy them a coffee, then they want something. Sometimes they want something sweet. If you give them to something sweet, then they might want a pack of smokes. I'm just kind of used to the progression.
Right.
Well, this fellow said to me, "I'll have whatever you're having. I'll go get us a table." I thought, well, that's odd.
But he said he'll go get the table.
He did.
That is strange.
So I brought the coffee over, and we chatted, and he asked the spirits for my name, and he gave it to me. He told me my name was the Stone Buffalo, which I was thought was a very good name to have. And over the course of the next 2 hours, we had a long conversation. He told me he was a shaman, that he'd been trained to be a shaman since he was 16 years old. And he said, "I'm an alcoholic. You should know that about me." He said, "That explains why I look the way I do and why I'm in the situation I am." And I thought that was very honest of him.
And he knew it, yeah.
And he knew it. So as we sat there chatting, I thought, well, you know, I'm not the kind of person to ask for advice, but he really seems to know what he's talking about. So I thought, well, I'm going to ask him about these shadows, these things I'd seen. And I told him the stories I've just told you, and he looked at me, and he looked very concerned. And he said, "I don't know why you're having these dreams, but I'll try to find out." And I stopped him then. I said, "Well, these aren't dreams." And he said, "It's better we call them dreams," which I thought was, again,
he seemed like a pretty knowledgeable guy about these things.
He absolutely did. I've never encountered anyone before or since who seemed to be as secure in their knowledge of these strange, otherworldly things.
How do you know he wasn't like some angel or something?
I don't at all. And it's given what happened following this, it's entirely possible. And the effect he had on my life.
Just from that encounter.
Just from the brief, truncated ceremony that followed in full view of the patrons of a very busy Starbucks on a very busy street.
That is amazing.
Early Sunday.
That's a great story.
So he pulled from his bag a purple plastic recorder. It was translucent, as I recall, and the kind of thing a child learns to play in band. And he blew the same note on it 15 times. He looked around, he shook his head, reached into his bag again, and he pulled out a maraca. It was purple, or I should say gray plastic, with Olmeca tequila on the side and faded red lettering. And I remember noticing that and kind of laughing to myself.
Yeah.
And he shook it a few times, and he made a sing-songy humming, and he looked around, and he kind of shook his head. And then he got up. And I thought I heard him say something about a doctor. And then he walked away. And I thought, oh, are we done? But before long, he came back, and he had a handful of something, which before I could even have a chance to look at properly, he shoved in my mouth.
Oh. Exactly. It could have been crickets, for all you know.
It could very well have been. I recognized the scent. It was some kind of plant matter. And he said to me, chew it down and swallow it.
Oh, no. There's no way I'd do that.
Well, that's it. I realized I've reached a point now. I can either go, phew, forget you, old man. I'm out of here. Or I can chew the stuff and see what happens. And it's not like me, but I chewed the stuff, George. And, you know, he looked at me and he said, did you swallow it all? I said, yep. He goes, okay. So he puts some of whatever it is in his own mouth. He chews it. And he puts his hands on either side of my head, pulls me forward, and blows on the top of my head. Now, I thought he chewed this stuff up and spit it on me, and I thought, oh, gross. But he hadn't. And then he pulled my head forward again, and he blew again on the back of my neck. And he repeated that all the way down my spine, sat me back up, looked at me sideways, and said, okay, it's done. And he sat back down. Now, at this point, I'm thinking, what's done?
Yeah.
So I asked him, and he said, you'll see. Sure enough, over the next few minutes, this strange feeling came over me, like it's hard to describe, this sense of otherness. I was very aware of my hands, but it was like they belonged to someone else, and I was merely issuing instructions.
It was the stuff he made you eat.
Entirely possible. But eventually the feeling came over my whole body, and I said, Dennis, I'm going to fall over. And he said, you're not going to fall over. I said, I'm going to pass out. He said, you're not going to pass out. Just relax.
He poisoned you, Brennan.
That's what I thought. And I thought, okay, so if I throw up some of this stuff now, take a little bit of it, the hospital's not far, and I'm making all these plans.
Hold on. Let's finish the story when we come back. We'll talk more about some of the episodes out there in Revelstoke, and we'll take phone calls about the strange and unusual.